talking about an experiment that apparently shows there were some particles that travel faster than the speed of light. I should tell you that I've mastered that also, so my lecture's really already finished. You just didn't notice that I went so fast, the lecture's already over. I hope people heard that. It was a good joke, so I hope people heard that. The last time I was telling you that Austrian economics is much simpler than mainstream neoclassical economics, but in mainstream economics, they emphasize a great deal very complicated mathematical formulas that you have to learn when they're setting up their models, and then they have further mathematics involving testing whether the prediction model come out true. You have to learn all sorts of complicated math, but the Austrian view is very simple, and I tried to show that in utility and also Austrian view competition. Now, there's just one problem, maybe more than one problem, but one problem I thought when I was looking at the quiz that I gave you, it showed me I didn't do a good job in showing that the Austrian view of utility is a very easy one. So I want to spend some time going over utility again. We'll go over some new points about it. So I want you to be able to understand what an easy concept this is. And in order that we can understand utility, we do have to get through one mistake a lot of people make about utility. So I'll be doing that. If we can just understand this one mistake, then the whole concept will be clear. And then after I do utility, then I'm going to go into more detail about competition. And remember last time I was giving you the Austrian view, and industry counts as competitive as long as there's no legal bars to entry or exit, no legal bars to anyone coming in the industry or leaving. And it does, the Austrian view is simple because you don't have any further requirements. I was mentioning the neoclassical view is much more complicated. They have various requirements involving how the market is structured, basically how many firms are in each industry. And their view is much more complicated. So what I'm going to do after I get through talking about utility is I'm then going to talk about the neoclassical view and what the Austrian criticisms of it would be. And we'll see we need to understand utility first because that plays an extremely important part in this whole controversy between the Austrians and the neoclassicals about competition and monopoly. So, as I say, judged by the quiz, I didn't fully succeed in showing how easy the Austrian view of utility is, so I hope you'll give me a chance in this lecture, second chance to do it. Now, whenever you have money, which for me is not a very frequent occurrence, I'm usually out of money, whenever you have money, you have to decide what products you want to buy. So you get your salary, so you might say, well, what am I going to spend all my money on? How am I going to decide how to spend the money? Now, it's very important to remember, when you buy something, you're buying a particular amount of it. Say you're buying a pound of apples, or you buy one car. You don't buy the whole category, apples or cars. Now that sounds like a trivial point. You know, who would think when you're going to the market, you're buying all the apples in existence? But that point nevertheless tripped up a lot of the economists before the 19th century. a lot of economists ignored that point. They thought that you couldn't come up with a good theory of prices based on utility because they didn't realize, they didn't take full account of the fact that when you buy something, you're just buying particular amounts of it, not the whole class. You're just buying a particular amount of something. So how do you decide what you're going to buy? Well, what you do, you're trying to, what you do is you rank the different products available to you. Remember, what you're ranking is particular amounts of these products. You're saying something like, well, I can buy, how would I rank, say, buying a pound of apples? What about buying a car, one car? I would get a ranking of all the different things I can buy with my money. So then when I said it depends on the rank, so then you have the further question, well, how do I decide how these products rank? Well, that depends on how you value what you can do with the products. You would say, well, what would I have certain money, there are various products available to me, so what would I most like to spend it on? What's the highest value I can get of the various products available to me? So if you do that, you will then spend your money on this list of the products that you value until your money runs out. You'll pick your highest value rank product first, and then you just go down the list. So supposing, say, I earn my usual $50 a week, so then I'll just say, well, what can I spend it on? What are things available to me for $50? So I'll be able to decide what products to buy based on the list I have and ranking the products available to me, so I'll pick the highest ranking one I can first, and then go down the list. Well, I just see someone is asking in the chat, are there going to be any more quizzes? Yeah, there's a quiz after each lecture. I'll try to make them, I try to make them easy. There were some people, I didn't do a good enough job in explaining utility last time because there were some people who missed some of the questions on that. So I'll try to improve on that. So as I say, you're ranking all these different products you can buy. So that ranking, this ranking, is what we mean by utility. So the ranking, how a product ranks on your list, is the good's utility to you. Now that doesn't seem very difficult, does it? Just saying how a product ranks gives it its utility. So if you'd rather have apples, let's say a pound of apples and a pound of oranges, so then apples have more utility to you because it has a higher rank. That's just what we mean by utility. Now, there's one more thing we need to know in order to understand utility. I said so far is utility is the rank on your list. When you're ranking all the things you could buy, then the rank will determine how the utility of the good. The rank is the utility, so where it is on your list. Now, suppose I gave you an example, say, when you'd be comparing, you'd be ranking, say, a pound of apples versus a pound of oranges. Now, suppose we're talking about, this, we can also, though, have rankings of the same product. Like we say, well, how about 1 pound of apples? How about another pound of apples? A third pound of apples? So if you keep buying more of the same product, the new units will rank lower on your list. We can see, why is that? Why won't it be that, say, you buy your fifth pound of apples will be worth more than the first? Why would it be worth less? Well, because you'll use each unit of the product you buy for the highest value goal then available on your list. Say you want to have your first pound of apples, say you want to eat them. Of course, you ate a pound of apples, it probably wouldn't be such a good idea if you ate them all at once, but never mind that. So supposing that's your highest value goal. So that's what you're going to use your first pound of apples for. Now, supposing, say, if you bought another pound of apples, you would use that to make apple pies. But you don't value that as much as eating the apples by themselves. Just bought, using it for a pie doesn't, you don't value that as highly. So then your second pound of apples, you won't rate as highly just because you want to satisfy your highest value goals before you satisfy the ones that aren't as high. So you're always going to, when you buy units of the same product, you're going to devote each further use to something with the highest value then available to be lower than for the previous unit. You said, well, I'm going to devote the first unit I buy to the highest goal I could achieve with that product, second highest goal. You go down your list, so the units, if you buy more and more units of the good, it'll go down in value. And this principle where you say, if you keep buying more of the same products, the new units will rank lower on your list. This is called the law of diminishing marginal utility. I see Brian has made a point, anticipated what I'm going to be saying next. Good, Brian. I'm glad you're able to anticipate what I'm going to be saying. Maybe I'm sure you could do a good, maybe you should give a lecture, but then that wouldn't be a good idea because then you would get paid and not me, so cancel that suggestion. All right, so I would say the principle is called law of diminishing marginal utility. And I mentioned so far goods, I'd say, well, you have money and you can use the money to buy different goods with it. But we realize, remember, money itself is a good. People want money. And the same point applies, same law applies to money. Say you're going to use, say, your first $100 to buy something really essential. If you keep getting more and more money, you'll be able to use it for it. Money won't be worth as much to you because what you'll be able to get with it would be goods that aren't as valuable. So you won't, after a point, you won't be going after money as much as you did at first. Say, most people say, don't work the maximum they're physically capable of. And why is that? You say, well, if you work as much as you possibly could, you would get more money, and so don't you want money? But why is it most people don't do that? Well, they want, as they keep getting more money, the money units of money become less valuable to them, and then other things, such as leisure, become more valuable. So they won't do everything they possibly could to get as much money as possible, because money, just like all the other goods, has diminishing marginal utility. Say, probably for Bill Gates, say getting $1 million, and wouldn't be $1 million now wouldn't be as important for him as getting his first $1 million was, because he could use the first $1 million for things that are much more important to him than, say, his last million. I wish he'd send with me a spare million or two. He probably wouldn't even miss it. Now, as I say, utility so far sounds pretty easy, but we have to get through. There's a basic mistake, and this is one that trips up a lot of people. So it's extremely important that we get through this basic mistake if we're going to understand utility properly. Wait, I just think I missed anything in the chat. I hope not. What I want to start with is something that might seem a bit off topic, but as I'll show it isn't. We can determine how much pain we're feeling, at least roughly. For example, say sometimes if probably a lot of you have been to doctors or you've been in hospital, and the doctor can ask you to estimate how much pain you feel on a 1 to 10 scale. So I say, how much pain are you in now listening to my lecture? I hope most of you would give it less than 7 or so. But you could do that. You could say, well, I'm in excruciating pain and I'm just mildly uneasy. That would be easy to do. Now we could imagine, and this is what actually people try to do, is we could construct a scale like that for how happy we feel. So instead of having a doctor say, rate on a scale how much pain you feel in 1 to 10 scale, we could imagine a similar scale on how happy you feel, say, from being mildly in a good mood to being ecstatically happy. So Jeremy Bentham, who is a famous late 18th, early 19th century British philosopher, used, a legal reformer, used the word utility to mean scales of pleasure and pain. So when he was talking about utility, he meant something like measuring how much in pain you were in or measuring how happy you felt, the way I've explained it. So you notice this is a different concept of utility, a different meaning for utility from what I was talking about before. When I said, when we talk about utility in economics, at least in Austrian economics, we just talked about a ranking of things you buy on a scale depending on what, how much you value what you can do with the product. So this is a different concept of utility. This is saying this concept of utility is saying how much pleasure or pain you can feel just based on the scale of how you're estimating. So the basic mistake, as you probably guessed, is confusing these two concepts. Utility is ranking goods by how much value they have to you, and utility in the sense of trying to measure how happy you are, how much pain you're feeling. And I think it is notion of measurement of pleasure and pain in the way that the 18th century philosopher Jeremy Bentham and his followers talk about utility. This is not what we mean by utility in Austrian economics. I'm just repeating this because it's extremely important that we get it, we get it right. All we mean by utility in Austrian economics is how you rank your goals or how you rank the product that enables you to reach these goals. Now, you can, if you want, have as a goal getting pleasant feelings and avoiding pain. Probably most people do have those goals. Supposing you find yourself with a very bad headache, like say you're going over listening to my video, one of my lectures, so naturally you get a bad headache. So you want to say, how do I avoid that? That's a goal a lot of people have, avoiding pain or getting pleasant feelings. So those can be your goals. You could have those as your goals could include that, but they don't have, you don't have to have those. You can have other goals. So you say you just like apples. It isn't that they give you particular feelings. You just happen to like them or you want them. So is that would be like determine that they rank above certain other things that you don't like, but it wouldn't have anything to do necessarily with getting pleasant feelings and avoiding pain. So now we can see exactly where this mistake I'm talking about comes in. Now, as you know, in Austrian economics, we say you can't measure utility. You can't measure utility between persons, so I can't say I prefer apples more than you prefer apples, and I prefer apples more than you prefer oranges. And you can't even measure utility within a person, so I can't say my utility for me of apples is twice the utility for oranges for me. So what this means, the reason we can't measure utility in Austrian economics is simply that all utility means is the rank of goods, so there's nothing to measure. Say if I say apples ranks higher than oranges, there's nothing there to measure. I guess Brian asked a question, do the term satisfaction, dissatisfaction work in the Austrian view, or do they fall short for similar reasons, pleasure, pain? Well, that's an excellent question. That depends what you mean by satisfaction. If you can just mean by satisfaction where the good stands on your rank ordering, then it's all right. But sometimes satisfaction is used to mean pleasure and pain, and then it wouldn't be good. So it just depends how you take it. But I say the key point to realize is that there's nothing to measure. Now, sometimes you'll have people arguing like this. They'll say, well, the reason you can't measure utility is something like, say if I'm measuring something up there, say how long something is, I can just take a ruler and see how, put it against the object, like try to measure how long is my computer screen. I just take a ruler, put it next to the computer screen, then I know how long it is. But they think, well, for things like utility, this is all inside my mind, like how do I feel about apples? So there's no unit you could really come up with. There's no fixed unit you could come up with. It's just subjective. Now, that isn't the right way to look at it, but a lot of people do look at it that way. Now, that's the thing we have to avoid. It isn't that because utility is mental, we can't figure out objectively what the appropriate unit is. There is no unit, you see. All we have is a ranking of goods, so there's nothing we can measure. So it isn't that it isn't that something like, well, unfortunately, we don't have a scale for utility because it's all subjective. It's just that all we have is a rank of goods, so we don't have anything to measure. And so it's extremely important that we grasp that distinction. So I hope I've harped on it enough. If you'd like, I'd be happy to go over it a few 100 more times. As they say, you know, Lewis Carroll has in his poem, Hunting the Snark, there's the line, what I tell you three times is true. So what I've said so far about utility is therefore true. So Brian says, is utility subjective ranking preferences? Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, as long as you remember that it's not measuring it's not measuring anything. It's not saying, well, it's a measurement, but there's no objective unit, so it's objective measurement. That's the wrong way to look at it. It's just ranking or preferences. You know, one reason it's important to understand the Austrian view of utility is that the neoclassicals take a different view. I'm not going to go into detail on what their view is. They don't say you can measure utility, but they tend to think that there's more to utility than just this pure notion of ranking. And we'll see later on, this is one reason their view of competition differs from the Austrian position. So what I now want to do is talk about utility enough, but now I want to go into the competition where we contrast the Austrian view with the neoclassical view. So now, first what we have to understand prices, a little bit about prices if we're going to understand this competition. Now, suppose you're trying to sell something, say a bucket of golf ball. What price should you charge? How would you decide what price to charge for the bucket of golf ball? Well, suppose you select a price. Now, what would happen? What would you know about what would happen if you lower your price? So I said, well, I'm going to sell golf balls for $3 each. So I wouldn't know how many people would buy that golf ball for $3 each. But what I would know is if you lower your price, then you'll sell either the same amount or more. You won't sell less. It won't be the case that raising the price, if I raise the price of golf balls from $3 to $30, I'm not going to sell more of them. The lower price, I'll sell the same amount or more. And why is that? Well, this is easy to understand because we were going over this when I was talking about utility. When you have money, remember you have various things you can use the money to buy with. Say you're going to buy first what you value most, then you're going on to the next thing. So you have to make choices between all the goods available. And if a good costs a lot of money, then you'll have less to buy on other things. Say if you suppose you have $200, so you're not going to be able to, if you have other things you want to buy, you're not going to be able to buy very many $30 golf balls. But if the price were low, then you wouldn't have to give up all these other goods. So this is why if you lower the price, you're not going to get people buying more. So some goods are more responsive to price changes than others. Some goods, if you lower the price, you'll get a lot more people buying the goods than others. And goods that are very responsive to prices, but they have an elastic demand curve. The demand curve will just be showing for each price how much is people will buy. So you can get the price for each price, say if it's $3 a golf ball, you'll be able to sell, say, 50 golf balls. If it's $2, you'll be able to sell 75 golf balls. So you could draw a curve. I didn't draw anything because I'm horrible at drawing. And remember how many demand and supply curves are there shown in Mises' Human Action. Can anybody tell me that? How many commandments apply to subjecting human action? Zero, that's right, there are none. I think there's one commandments apply curve in socialism. The Mises didn't go in for commandments apply curves very much, but you can you see the basic concept is for some goods, if you lower the price, you'll get a lot more people buying. If you raise the price, that'll really cause a drastic drop in how many people, how much people will buy. That's called having an elastic demand curve. And there's some goods that if you lower the price, you won't get that much more quantity that's sold. That sometimes people want a certain good, and within a certain range, they'll buy it even if the price is higher. So salt is an example of one that has an inelastic demand curve, at least over a certain range. It doesn't cost that much to begin with, and people want it. So say even if the price doubled, probably you wouldn't cut down on your salt very much. So that's what that would be inelastic over, at least within a certain price. Of course, you raise the price, say, to $100 for a pinch of salt, you're not going to get many people buying it. But within a certain range, even if you raise the price, people would still buy it about as much as before. So that would be an example of an inelastic demand curve. We'll see why why this is extremely important to understanding competition monopoly. Now, suppose there's only one seller of a good. Supposing I own all the golf balls in existence. I was really good going out and driving ranges and scooping up all the lost golf balls, so I own them all. So then, how would I set a price? Well, I can try to estimate how much people will buy the golf ball at each price. And so then I can compare my estimate of what I will make, say, selling the golf ball at this particular price, with the cost of selling the golf ball at that price. Now, if it turns out the demand curve is inelastic in some range, I can raise the price and make more money. Remember, inelastic demand curve won't respond very much to change in the prices. So supposing, say, changing the price of a golf ball from $3 to $3.50 each, say, I'll just get maybe one or two people who drop out and don't buy any golf balls at the higher price. So it could turn out that I can make more money if I raise, if I have a higher price. So if you have that situation, where you're the only seller and you can raise the price and make more money, in the neoclassical view, that is what counts the monopoly price. So see, if I did that, say I raised the price I would be charging would be above my cost, because remember, supposing we start with a price where I'm just barely covering my cost, then I find I can raise the price and sell the same amount or maybe slightly fewer. So my costs haven't changed, but my price, I get more because I'm selling at a higher price, so my price is above my cost. Now, in the neoclassical view, then I'm able to get monopoly gains because I'm selling at a higher price and still making more money. Now, supposing there were other firms competing with me, then I couldn't do that, because suppose I said, well, I'm going to raise the price, I'll get more if I won't lose very much in quantity if I raise the price to $3.50 instead of $3, so why don't I do that? Well, then if there are other people selling golf balls, they could undersell me and drive the price down again. So in this neoclassical view, we have a monopoly if we're in the situation, because of the inelastic demand curve over a certain range, I can restrict the quantity I sell and make more money. Now, one thing Mises pointed out, that you would be doing here, is that you're getting the monopoly price on this view depends on this demand curve, so inelastic demand curve. So it isn't the case that whenever you have a single seller is able to charge monopoly price. It just depends on this shape of the demand curve. Oh, I saw, just one digression here, I saw somebody had a question where I was saying Bentham's notion of measuring pleasure and pain is different from the Austrian view. So the question is, it's a very good question, isn't scaling the pain a type of ranking? Well, it is, but it's much more than a ranking. Certainly, they could say, well, measurement of 10 in pain is worse than, say, just the measurement of 2. That's certainly ranking, but it's more than that. It's a measurement, and that's the part that we don't have in the Austrian view of utility. So I just thought I'd mention, we have an extremely good question. So getting back to what I was saying, assuming I can remember what I was saying, you know, I'm old now, I don't remember things the way I used to, so I have to watch what I say. So if neoclassical say, well, if I can do that, if I can raise the price because I'm the only seller and make more money, then I have a monopoly. And we have to ask, well, is this, so what? Is this a bad state of affairs? Is monopoly bad? And the neoclassical economists say it is, because they say when prices are above cost, you can increase utility by lowering the price. Now, you might think that the neoclassical argument is obviously wrong, because remember, I said, I just show you can't measure utility. I said the notion of measuring utility doesn't make sense. So you might say, well, if you can't measure utility, how can you say that utility has gone up? Doesn't that sound like there's something wrong with it? But the neoclassicals have an answer to this. They say, and I'm not going to go into detail of how they do this, but they have diagrams where they try to show it. They say they can show that if you don't measure utility, they can still show the monopoly price has lower utility than the competitive price. And this is called the deadweight loss from monopoly. I don't like the neoclassical argument that you guys do, but I like that phrase, deadweight loss. It has a certain ring to it, I think. Now, what would the Austrians say in response to this? Well, one thing would be, kind of an obvious point, is the neoclassical arguments depend on knowing how much of a good would be demanded at various prices. They would say, I would know that if I sold the golf balls at $3, I'd sell, say, 100. If I sold them at $3.50, I'd sell 95. So I'd have to be able to fill in all these prices. I know if I have to have a lot of speculative information, and it would probably turn out that I wouldn't be able to fill in these things. And how could we find these things out? All we know is the actual price, what I'm selling the good at, and how much is bought at that price. And estimates of other prices are speculative. So also, even though the Austrians say they aren't trying to measure utility, they seem to be taking utility to be more than just ranking of goods. I'm not going to go into the technical details of why that's true, but basically when they're talking about utility, they mean more than just putting the goods in a certain order. They're putting all sorts of probability estimates of different baskets of goods. And this is a much more demanding concept. There's much more to it than the Austrian view, which is simply ranking the actual goods. So if you use the Austrian view, it's harder to get this argument going. Remember, their argument, they say, well, utility, they can show if you have a monopoly price, which means that you're getting more by raising the price, you're getting more, earning more, getting more profit by raising the price, then there's a loss of utility. You would get more utility by lowering the price, more total utility. So the point, rather than going to the technical detail, as I said, we're trying to make things easy. We want to make them easy for me because I'm not very good at technical detail, at least in economics. So I like to make things easy for me as well as for you. So let's suppose the neoclassical argument is correct. And we want to ask the question, so what? Why should we demand that the market meet the ideal of increasing utility? Why do we have to conform to that standard? Suppose we say, well, I don't think this neoclassical argument is right that when you have a monopoly price in the sense that you're getting more by raising the price, because when you have the demand curve, then you could raise utility by lowering the price. So why should we care about that? Now, one of the points I want to make here, this is one of the most important points I think you need to bear in mind for the whole course. I'd be very happy if this is one of the things you remembered in the whole course, is that it's extremely important to keep ethical judgment about what should be the case, apart from judgment about what is the case. So we have to say, if you're saying something like, well, we should increase utility, that's not a statement of a scientific statement, that's a statement of an ethical statement, what should be the case. So in the Austrian view, as I was mentioning the last time, competition exists as long as there's free entry and exit into the industry, as long as the government isn't telling you can't sell golf balls, only the ones people we say can sell golf balls can do so. So as long as you have free entry and exit, that counts as competitive industry. And we don't impose requirements such as maximizing utility on the market. But George Riesman, who's a very good economist, I should say, has a very strong resemblance to Mr. Peanut in Mr. Peanut ad. He calls the neoclassical position platonic competition. He said, well, they have a certain ideal, such as like Plato's ideal, and they try to judge the market by these ideals. But he said, look, what we're concerned with is what actually takes place on the market. Why should we accept these particular standards? Now, there's an obvious objection to what I'm saying. And I suppose you say, well, isn't it obvious that an increase in total utility is a good thing? Even if it is an ethical judgment, isn't it a non-controversial one? Suppose you say, well, okay, suppose I said something like, we shouldn't start an all-out nuclear war because it would blow up the entire Earth, and human life on Earth. So I'm making an ethical judgment, but it isn't a very controversial one. Somebody could say, well, isn't it, if we can show that Nazi prices or decreased utility, isn't that pretty obvious ethical judgment we were making? There is an ethical judgment. But well, I see some people are agreeing with me about that George Reason looks like Mr. Peanut. Well, I'm glad those people automatically get A's in the course. So what I want to say is the view that we should always act to increase utility really non-controversial? Well, it doesn't seem like it is. Like one thing, I didn't put this in slide, one thing we should remember is, supposing lowering the price would increase overall utility, well, it wouldn't be good for the monopolist. He would lose by it. Now, you could say, well, but even you could compensate the monopolist, there'd still be a net increase. That's what the neoclassicals would say. But we would still want to ask, is the view that we should always act to increase utility really that non-controversial? Well, let's take something like a holiday, say Christmas, people give each other presents. So we could argue, well, sometimes say you give somebody a present, but it turns out the person doesn't really want it, and he takes it, he or she takes it to the store and exchanges it. So we could say, well, there's a deadweight loss from presents that people don't like. They give somebody a present, you have to go down to the store and change it. Maybe sometimes you can't do that, so there's a loss. So couldn't we eliminate this deadweight loss and increase utility if instead of giving people a present, it would just you just give the cash or a check on what you intend to spend, so there'd be an increase in utility that would be eliminating this deadweight loss. But it isn't obvious that that would be a good thing to do, you see. So just from the fact that something, if it is a fact, if something increases total utility, that isn't a conclusive reason to do it. So what we have to realize is, again, it's an important distinction to bear in mind, is if something has good consequences, that gives you a reason to do it. If it has bad consequences, you have a reason to avoid it. But those aren't conclusive reasons. Other reasons can override them, for example, people's rights. And supposing, say, this single cell, imagine I own all the golf balls, well, I'm getting higher, I'm getting earning profit because I'm charging a certain price. And they said, well, I have this argument that shows if you lowered your price, we could increase total utility, and you wouldn't lose out because we could compensate you, but the consumers would be better. Well, what if I have a right to sell the product for whatever I can get in the market? We don't, maybe one could argue, I mean, probably most Austrians would argue, you don't have a right to interfere with the person. So neoclassical economists often take for granted the view that utility is the only standard, but this is something they should do. Now Theo's raised, but the total utility includes the monopoly utility. So what if his utility drops? Overall utility gone up? Well, that's an excellent point, Jay. I was trying to deal with that. That's just what they would say, that the total utility has gone up because they could give him all the utilities lost and he still some sort of left over. But what I was saying is, even if that's true, then that doesn't give us the conclusive reason to do it. You see, what you're saying is perfectly right. The technical term for that would be it'd be Caldor Hicks efficient to do it. Now, you don't have to worry about that. I just thought I'd throw that out to show that I know that particular technical term. But you see what the difference is there. Is that even if total utility does go up, because argument shows that, so what? It doesn't, it isn't conclusive on what to do. Now, suppose we talked so far about how the neoclassicals view monopoly. They say, well, if you have a single seller, and because the demand curve is inelastic over a certain range, means he can raise his price, he won't lose very much in sales, so he can make more money. So they say this is a monopoly price. Now, one problem for that is that there aren't that many concepts of, there aren't that many cases of monopoly, because most products have more than one seller. So if the neoclassicals wanted to say the market is flawed or deficient because of these monopoly prices, they wouldn't have very many cases to use. So what they do is they've extended this concept of deadweight loss far beyond monopoly. They say that in order to eliminate deadweight loss, there have to be an extremely large number of firms that sell the identical product. Because they say, well, even if we have more than one seller, there's still going to be this deadweight loss unless we have an extremely large number of firms that sell the identical product. So in the situation that they have in mind, a seller can sell any amount he wants at the market price. So they call this being, the seller is a price taker. He has to take whatever the market price is. And so he has no influence at all on the price. So we're not going to have the situation where somebody can raise the price because taking advantage of an inelastic demand curve and make more money. He can sell any amount he wants at the market price. And the demand curve facing each seller is perfectly elastic. If he raises his price at all, he won't sell anything. So he can sell anything he wants at the market price as a price taker. If he tries to raise his price, he'll lose all his business. And his price isn't above his cost, so he won't lower it. You know, he wouldn't be like the man who said, I sell below cost. Somebody said, well, you sell below cost, how do you make your money? So I make it up in volume. And that wouldn't work. So he's not going to sell below the market price because then he's selling below cost. He can't sell above because then he won't have any sales at all. So if you have that condition where a person is selling any amount he wants at market prices, nothing above a market price, that's called, remember all the people in the industry selling an identical product, that's called pure competition. Now if we add that all the people in the market have complete knowledge of all price and quantity, then we have perfect competition. It's a very strict requirement. So you have to have people selling the identical product, the demand curve perfectly horizontal. Let's say they can't sell anything at all above the market price. They sell nothing if they try to sell above the market price. And each firm has no influence at all on price. Each firm is a price taker. So almost nothing qualifies as perfectly competitive. There's almost nothing, no industries where you have a situation where people are selling the absolutely identical product and have no influence at all on the price. Probably the closest is agriculture, certain types of agriculture, like say people are selling wheat on the market where they don't have much influence. One bushel of wheat is just the same as any other bushel. And they're so vast quantities of wheat that are bought and sold that a single farmer couldn't really affect the price. Now, this perfect competition model of neoclassicalism has major problems. And one of them is that everybody's a price taker. Nobody can set, it can influence the price. Each seller just has to take the price on the market. So this raises a problem with a number of economists, even some of the neoclassicals point out, is, well, if everybody's a price taker, where does the price come from? It has to be set by someone. So you get kind of an internal difficulty in the theory, saying everybody's a price taker, but if everybody's a price taker, then where does the price come from? Now, another problem for this theory is demand for the whole industry can't be perfectly elastic. And we said each firm has perfectly elastic demand curve. A firm can't affect the price at all. A firm can't say, well, if I try to raise my price and make more money. If the firm tried to do that, then it lose all its business. So each firm has a perfectly elastic demand curve. But that wouldn't be true for the whole industry. Imagine everybody in the whole industry merged into one firm, then they raise the price. Well, some people would still want the product, even if the price were right. Let's say something like the government nationalizes production of all the wheat farmers. So then if the government raised the price, some people would still want wheat. It wouldn't be the case that if the whole industry raised the price, the whole, nobody would want any. So the industry demand curve isn't perfectly elastic. It isn't a horizontal one. Some people still want the product if the price were to rise. But the way you get the demand for the industry is just by adding up the curve for each firm. So you get a big problem because the demand for each firm is perfectly horizontal. So you're adding up all these horizontal demand curves, then you're supposed to come up with a demand curve for the industry that isn't perfectly horizontal. So that's a contradiction there. So there are problems, severe problems with pure perfect competition model. But nevertheless, the neoclassicals will very often use this to criticize the free market and say, well, we can come up with whenever you have a price that isn't perfectly competitive by this model, and that shows you could gain utility by lowering the price. So the problem that the neoclassicals have, though, is it's almost nothing qualifies as perfectly competitive. The neoclassicals have to have an account of the rest of the economy. So there are some people in the neoclassical section, members of the Chicago School, such as Milton Friedman, they think that the actual economy isn't that far away from perfect competition. Remember from my first lecture, I was mentioning Friedman doesn't think that a model has to have completely true assumptions. So he said, well, even if you don't, the model says you have to have completely identical products and everyone's a complete price taker. So if it generates predictions that are basically correct, even if the real world isn't exactly like that, it's still a good idea to use this for the competition model. But most neoclassicals say, no, we can't. We have to have other, we have to change the model. So what they say is, apart from monopolies, apart from where you have cases of a single seller, the structure of the market is either one of monopolistic competition or oligopoly. Now, monopolistic competition sounds like a contradictory phrase, but what people who support this view have in mind is, in monopolistic competition, there are a lot of firms. It isn't the case where there's just a few firms in the industry. So each one has a slight influence on the price. So supposing, say, you have, say, people are selling, different people are selling fruit. So each fruit seller can change the price slightly. Each seller isn't just a price taker. And the products are slightly different. Say, suppose you're going to a supermarket and you're looking for brands of toothpaste. You say, well, you can buy Colgate or Crest or all sorts of other things. So that basically toothpaste isn't that much different from one brand to another, but there are differences. Some people, they taste slightly differently. Some people will only get, will very much prefer one kind to another kind. So unlike pure competition, the products are slightly different. So in the neoclassical view, each firm has a slight degree of monopoly power because it isn't a price taker. And very often, monopolistic competition theories will criticize advertising. They say, well, how will we, in this, say the market is one monopolistic competition, well, how will a firm try to get more profit? Say, how can it get people to buy its products? And I'm the manufacturer of Crest toothpaste. How can I get people to buy Crest and not Colgate? Well, I can advertise, I have a big campaign to advertise, buy Crest and Colgate taste bad. You should buy Crest instead. So according to these theories, they say, well, that's a waste of money. They're just trying to show spending all this. They're not really producing anything. They're just trying to devote all this money showing their product is somehow better than the other. So in their view, this is wasteful. And again, we can see how they're just saying, they're trying to judge the market by their own particular standard, ethical standard. Now, the other thing, we have monopolistic competition. We have a lot of different firms and products slightly different. Now, an oligopoly, that has a business condition market structure. We have a few very large firms that compete with each other. So each firm has a great deal of influence on the price. It isn't just like a monopolistic competition. Say each firm, say the fruit seller, can slightly affect the price, but in an oligopoly, which is just a few large firms, they can have a big effect on the price if they change the price. So in here, in oligopoly, remember, in perfect competition, we have to have identical products. In monopolistic competition, we have products that are slightly different. Here in oligopoly, we don't have any specification. The product can be either exactly the same or slightly different. Then we have, say, an example would be, say, oil companies. Say there are a few big firms that are selling oil, so we have an oligopoly. So here, when the firm is trying to set its price, it has to, and how much to produce, it has to estimate how much, what its rivals will do when it decides on price and production. Say, in other cases, say, not just the competition, perfect competition, you don't have to do that as much because the firm will not have much effect on the price. So now, what I'm going to include is just point out the Austrian view of competition is much simpler than in your classroom, that we don't have to worry about all this stuff about market structure. Whatever people freely decide to do counts as competitive. So we can forget, all, if we're doing it in this Austrian view, we can forget all about this, learning all this stuff about monopolistic competition, oligopoly, elastic demand curves, and monopoly. We just take whatever people do on the market counts as competitive. So, okay, and I think I'll open it up for a question. I saw, before I going to click on the Q&A, I saw a couple of points people had raised in the chat I wanted to mention here. It raised some interesting points. Someone asked, I'm trying to find this. Wait, I didn't find it. If I can just reconstruct the question was, so I said, well, if we're talking about utility loss, doesn't that involve measurement? And I think the neoclassical view is saying that there's a deadweight loss in case of monopoly. But remember, the neoclassical claim, they can show that without measuring utility, they can show this just by drawing a diagram, there's this loss of utility. So they would say, no, you don't have to measure utility to show the deadweight loss. And I didn't go into detail on how they claim to do that, but I just said that the Austrian said you really couldn't put in that you really have to know a lot to do that, and then you might be using your demanding concept of utility in the line of the Austrian. So now I'm going to click on the Q&A and see what happens. When I do that, I'll be seeing your questions, but I won't be able to see myself on the video, but I've looked at myself enough already. I hope you'll still be able to see me if you want to. Okay, so we have the first question. Mary says, Professor, why is all this important, utility? Well, utility is important because this is the basis of how we determine prices. The price of it depends on the utility that people give it. And it's also important because we have to see, if we're going to understand this new class of you, we have to understand the competition. We have to see based on the notion of the deadweight loss in utility. Jay Steele asks if this ranking assumes rationality. We're not always rational in terms. How does this impact utility? Is this a valid assumption? Well, we're not assuming, again, when you say ranking, you're just taking this however you yourself rate the good. You're not saying you have to meet some particular demand of rationality. Mises said anything we do counts as rational action. Using the means to achieve. And so we're not saying your ranking, you have to follow certain principles of reason. Suppose somebody said, I'm going to blow my week's wages, I'm going to forget about food, I'm just going to buy drugs and booze. That would be the regular economic rationality would be perfectly applicable to that. We're not making any judgment about what would be reasonable or unreasonable to think to choose. Now, Martin says, sorry, language problem, and I'm American. What is a price taker? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't do a good job in explaining it. A price taker is somebody who just has to take the price. In other words, let's say you go into Walmart. You know, they say you're buying something, say you're offering something for, you say they buy a set of golf clubs for $200. So you have to pay you don't get to say to them, well, I'll give you $100. Normally, if you bought, you would just have to take the price. So in the neoclassical view of private competition, the government, I mean, people in the industry simply have to accept whatever the market price is. They can't influence the price. A price taker is someone who can't influence the price. We have a next question. Isn't the patent the government granted monopoly? Yes, but what about copyright? Well, those are very important issues, but I mean, that would be more, as a good cop-out, that would be more of a course, that would be more an issue for a different course, whether patents and copyright would count as monopoly ways of restricting entry into the industry. If they were, and I think you could make a good case for that, then that would be a monopoly, giving patent holders would have a monopoly privilege, and copyright holders would if you took that view. So it's a good question. I think it's basically analysis of patent monopoly really belongs to a different course. Okay, so let's see. Do we have some more questions here? Let's see, Brian says, would you please go over deadweight loss again? Well, Brian, I'll be happy to do that as long as my doing so doesn't involve a deadweight loss. Well, okay, remember we were talking about when, say, you were setting a certain price, so you say, I'm going to sell the golf ball at $3 for golf balls cost $3 each. So supposing I can raise the price to $3.50 and I make more money. So say my costs don't go up because I'm selling fewer of the golf balls, but my costs don't go up, but I'm making more money. Now the neoclassicals say in that situation, I've raised the price and I'm getting more money. I'm making more, but they say they can show that the consumers, the people who buy, are losing more than I gain. So I'm getting more, but the consumers are losing. They say they can show that by drawing diagrams. You can see there's a loss in utility if I can raise price and get more money. So that's what they mean by a dead weight loss. It's a loss in utility. Let's see, next question is, what happens to break even point? And what's the rest of this? What happens to break even point and supply and demand to set prices? Well, supply and demand are setting the price, you see, in all these cases. And what the neoclassicals say is, if you have a situation where the seller isn't at the break-even point, then there's some degree of monopoly power. So what the neoclassicals are saying is, the prices should really be at the break-even point to maximize utility. And now, next question is from Brian. So they claim that utility can be measured then in the deadweight loss of the No, this is a very good question. It's very important to realize. They're saying you can't measure it, but you can just see that it's more. So something like you're not being able to say, well, you're getting, say, utility measurement of 5 units of utility in one case and 7 in the other, they could just say you could see that you're getting more. Right, let me give you an example. Maybe this isn't making too much sense. But supposing somebody gives me, or let's say somebody gives you $100 and doesn't get changed in money, anybody else, or someone just gives me $100. So my utility has gone up. Say nobody else's utility has changed. So we can say utility is increased, but I haven't measured utility. I guess that's if my utility has gone up and nobody else has gone down, then mine has gone up. So if you don't, you can sometimes say utility has gone up or down, even if you can't measure utility. So the next question is, Steve White, so a buyer is able to haggle with the seller for a better price, and is the buyer no longer a price taker? That should, I'll refer to a buyer is able to influence the price in the process of haggling. Well, I don't think there's a special term for that. But in that case, you're right, you wouldn't be a price taker because you'd be able to influence the price. So in when you're bargaining with people, you're neither of you is a price taker. A price taker is someone who just has to say, here's the price, I don't have any this price, but I can't change the price, because if I did, if I raised the price, and I wouldn't sell anything, I'm not going to lower it because the price is really, and I'd be selling below cost. I'll tell you one other story there. It reminds me, there was a man who was advertising, I sell at cost. And someone said to him, well, if you sell at cost, how do you make any money? He said, I buy below cost. Okay. The question here is dead weight loss going in a class or a loss of utility? Is this, do you mean, or transfer of utility? Well, it's the monopolist has gained utility and the consumers have lost, and it's a net loss because the consumers have lost more than the monopolist has gained. You see, so they say the monopolist goes up, the consumers go down, and the consumers go down more than the monopolist has gone up. Doug, can you define neoclassical economics for it? Well, by neoclassical, it's just basically the type of economics that's in sort of the dominant economics today, what you get if you took a regular course in the university department. It mainly follows, it has some of the, it's been influenced somewhat by Austrian economics, but also by other economists who are non-Austrian, like Alfred Marshall, who was a great great British economist. So just whatever they teach you in regular economics in neoclassical. Now, Brian said, if utility cannot be measured, how can it be said that monopoly increases utility less than consumer increases in aggregate? Well, what you have to do, I have to draw the diagram. I'm very bad at drawing these things, but you would see that sort of there's a bigger box that would be in the consumer's loss than in the monopolist gain. So when you're measuring something, what you're doing is saying, like, how many units are in this thing? So if I say this screen 18 inches, I'm saying how many unit inches are in the lens of this screen. So to see that one thing is bigger or smaller than another, it doesn't have to be measurement. Suppose I said that you see what the difference is. Now, Mark said you can't see the question. Well, I think you have to click on the Q&A button. I'm not asking me for advice. It's not, technical advice is not the best thing to do. But you see, getting back to Brian's question, you see what we could do, sort of a rough sense of this, we could say something like, say something like, what would be a good example? I suppose I say, well, I can see I'm shorter than Kobe Bryant, and I could see that even if I didn't measure his height or measure my height, I could just see the difference. So if you look at the way they do these diagrams in the neoclassical textbooks, you can see that one is more than the other without measuring. Now here's a question from Leslie. So the utilitarians say, not overriding life is more utility than overriding life. But doesn't this go against our common sense notion of morality? We don't say that not killing people is right because it's more utility than killing people. Yes, that's a very good point. Yes, I mean, not all utilitarians would say that not overriding rights have more utility than overriding rights. A lot of utilitarians would reject that, but you're right. If they accepted that, that wouldn't be the way we would put it in common sense morality. That's a very good point you raised. Okay. Let's see, and we have a few more minutes. I was so happy that people realized George Reason looks like Mr. Pima. That made my day. Okay, so let's see. We still have a few more minutes left. Oh yes, I see there's some people commenting on. Don't tell George Reisman I said that. He's going to. Well, now here's. Now somebody asked a question in the chat. Let me see this one. Chrissy says, we cannot compare utility among individuals. If the buyer accepts the good with a higher price raise my monopoly, he still fulfills the utility. This utility is the same. Buyer may not be able to purchase other goods in this point of view, so really the utility to have it otherwise. Isn't this argument making sense? So Chrissy, as I understand, oh, I see you raised the thing on the chat. Good. So what you're saying is, as I understand it, is if somebody's buying at the higher price, so at least he's getting more utility out of buying than he would from not buying, because we know you're buying it, so you must want it rather than not spending the money, but you do still better if you were able to buy at a lower price. Yes, that's perfectly right. That's right. So you're saying that way, that's a good way of understanding how utility could, that's an excellent point you should be teaching class. That's a way of saying how you could tell utility has gone down because you'd be doing better if you were able to buy it at a lower price. But still, since you're buying it at a higher price, you still want it, but you'd be able to do better if you buy at a lower price, so your utility has gone down. That's an excellent way of putting it. So see, that's a case where you could say you can't measure utility, you can still say utility for the person has gone down. That's an excellent point that you raised. I wish I'd thought of that. Good, let me see. Okay, we still have a few more minutes. Are people still able to see the video stream? Because I don't see myself anymore. I just see the question. Okay, we still have a little bit of time left. Do everybody understand everything? Okay. All right. Last chance. Everybody went. Oh, someone says, care to comment on the Fed's announcement yesterday? Well, I think I'm not up on all the technical details, but, the notion that the Fed can control it, what's happening is really one that I think isn't going to work. I think if we just rely on the free market, then we could get along perfectly well without the Fed. It's not only can get along without it, but it's dangerous to have one. So I'd say the Fed, having the Fed lowering overall utility, it also violates rights, so we can get it in any major, we can condemn it on any of the major ethical theories. Okay, here's one. A couple more questions. Leslie says, why do neoclassical economists still accept the free competition model when it's so unrealistic? Well, I think they think that it gives you a way of extending the notion of monopoly power. So they can say, well, whenever we find some case where these assumptions aren't met, then we can show there's something wrong with the market. So I think this gives them a reason to show, it's a way of showing there's something wrong with the market. And they can use it. They can say, well, it's unrealistic, but we can still try to fix particular industries that are deviate from that a lot. We can say, well, we can show that, say, some industries should have a lot of regulation because there's a lot of deadweight loss in these industries. And say, even if we don't have perfect competition, we can still, in effect, it's not there in reality, we can still use it as a way of judging the market. Carol says, did you say that Dr. Payne's scale is an ordinal or cardinal rank? It uses numbers, it still doesn't use numbers and then it allows using them in equations. Yes, that's a very interesting question. Well, it's certainly true that that most doctors would set it up. You wouldn't be measuring, according to say, units, the strict units of pain, but that isn't excluded in principle, and there are various people, they have a discipline called psychophysics that purports to claim that they can actually do come up with measurements of pain. So the pain scale would be a sort of a rough cardinal range. You wouldn't just be saying sort of a migraine headache is worse than, say, a mild stinging sensation in my finger. You would be trying to give a sort of rough approximation to them. Now, if Yashin, you approve free entrance exit and money spot, yes, I think you would, so people would be able to supply money privately. Of course, in Yashin, money would be a commodity, but people would be high accounts of pamphlet on competition and money, that it deals with that. Does anyone have a last question? I think we're about out of time, but if anyone has a last question or thanks everybody for coming to the lecture. Hope I'll see you again next week. Remember, next time for the lecture is on just for next week, it'll be Monday. And after that, for the rest of the lectures, it'll be back to the usual time on Thursday. So thanks very much, everybody. Thanks a lot. So I'll see you all. next week.